Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, August 24th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Public Hearing Set for City's Budget Tax Rate by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council want to hear from residents who want to weigh in on the budget and tax rate for the upcoming fiscal year. Public hearings for both will take place Tuesday during the regularly scheduled meeting. During a budget workshop in July, city officials heard the details of a $136,485 million general fund budget. The council has also proposed a tax rate of 36.4027 cents per $100 valuation. In agenda documents, the city reported that the proposed tax rate is 1.4% increase above the no new revenue for the general fund. The budget also will raise more total property taxes than last year's budget by $2.409 million, and of that amount, $1.605 million is tax revenue to be raised from the new property added to the tax roll this year, according to the city. City staff during the budget workshop earlier this summer reported that police and fire department expenditures will make up around 50% of the general fund expenditures. It was stated during the meeting that there isn't one single source of revenue that covers the combined budgets of both departments. It was stated then that property taxes will be the single largest revenue source for the upcoming fiscal year, $51.978 million. The sales tax forecast calls for $49.733 million in the upcoming fiscal year. Budget highlights include the reduction of 26 positions, the creation of 9 new positions, including a superintendent to manage the sports complex, and another to lead the new senior services division, and police department expenditures having to do with lieutenant pay, additional overtime, and certification pay. There will not be cost of living increases. The budget proposed by city staff maintains $6 million in street maintenance and $4.6 million in street improvements. That is money on top of the funds from the road bond passed in 2017. There also is $7.7 million included for the replacement and purchase of new vehicles, including 2 ambulances, 1 fire engine, and 8 police package SUVs. The proposed budget also shows about $69 million in the general fund balance savings. City officials also reported the average home value has increased from $269,475 in 2020 to $272,779 in 2021. Taxes rose accordingly from $982.82 to $1,001.27. City officials said those wishing to participate in person or online should be able to find the information needed on the council's posting of the meeting at its website. This article is entitled Dead End Food Shack Serves Scratch Comfort Food by J.C. Lewis. Midland's newest restaurant, Dead End Food Shack, offering made-from-scratch dishes, had a soft opening Saturday night and will officially open today. Hours will be 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and 4 to 9 p.m. daily. The menu features multiple burgers, including a Hatch chili burger and the Detour burger, which has double patties, bacon, cheddar, grilled jalapenos, and Thousand Island dressing. The roadkill fries are fresh fries topped with carne asada, sour cream, avocado, chimirrojo, cilantro, and is smothered with cheese. The menu's 2 chicken sandwiches are the Good Dill with dill chicken, dill mayo, lettuce, and pickled onion, and the Fat Chick, crispy chicken, bacon, cheddar, pickles, and Thousand Island slaw. Partners John Dacey and Jaime Del Campo decided to open the Dead End Food Shack after they felt as if their life and work had come to a dead end because of the coronavirus pandemic. "We wanted to complement the Detour Bar," Del Campo said. "I was also thinking that kind of felt like it was a dead end in life." Darcy said he loved the idea of calling it the Dead End Food Shack, so they went from there. The duo met while working at Basin Burger House, and when the restaurant closed, they decided to go into business together. Del Campo had been a chef and general manager. Darcy was a sous chef. Del Campo said they got along really well while working, and they both loved to cook. "We wanted to go in our own direction after Basin Burger closed," Darcy said. Del Campo said they bake their own bread from scratch, they make fresh fries, and they get their meat for patties from Midland Meat Company. "We're making everything from scratch," he said. "We want to make high-quality food and keep the tradition we had at Basin Burger, but give it our own touch." The Dead End Food Shack is beside the Detour Bar and shares a patio space at 1708 Rankin Highway. Del Campo said they hope to serve brunch once the Detour Bar is allowed to open again. Del Campo said his favorite items on the menu are cilantro curry wings and the Detour Burger. Darcy's favorite items include the Detour Burger and the carne asada tacos. Coming soon. Fair to Midland, which was slated to be finished this summer, will start construction the first week of September. The restaurant concept, designed by Austin-based KPG, will have entertainment and beverage options as well. Just announced. Opal's Table announced new dates for wine dinners. Tickets can be purchased at opalstable.com/events. September 17th, Asian Night Wine Dinner. October 8th, Nickel and Nickel Wine Dinner. October 29th, The Prisoner Wine Dinner. November 19th, Camus Wine Dinner. This is the opinion page. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled "Trump Deserves Credit for First Important Mideast Breakthrough" by Ben Shapiro, Creators Syndicate. Last week, while all eyes have been on the Democratic National Convention taking place via Zoom, truly historic events have occurred in the Middle East. A long-awaited peace deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, including full normalization of relations. Presumed peace deals to follow between Israel and Sudan, Oman, and Bahrain. The possibility on the horizon of a similar deal with Saudi Arabia. These are not only historic events, they are unmitigated goods. The recognition of a Jewish state in the Middle East is the precondition to any peace in the Middle East, and the formation of a durable coalition to stave off the aggressive Islamism of Iran provides more stability and greater deterrence in the region. It's easy to tell whether these are historic events by identifying those who oppose them. Iran is particularly angry. So is Iranian publicity agent Ben Rhodes, who served as former President Obama's deputy national security advisor. The tyrannical government of Turkey is deeply miffed. So is the terrorist government of the Palestinian Authority. All are angry for the same reason. The central myth of American Middle Eastern policy, formulated over the course of decades, has been thoroughly exposed. That myth suggested that in order for any peace to bloom in the Middle East, the West would have to apply pressure on the Israeli government to make concessions to the Palestinians, that Israel would have to abandon claims to East Jerusalem, to the Golan Heights, to areas of Judea and Samaria. That myth has been repeatedly tarnished by events of the last several years. When America moved her embassy to Jerusalem, foreign policy experts assured the public that the so-called Arab Street would be set aflame. Instead, nothing happened. When America recognized Israel's former annexation of the Golan Heights, foreign policy experts said that the Middle East would become a tinderbox. Nothing happened. Now Arab nations are openly forming alliances with the Jewish state, fully acknowledging that Israeli-Palestinian issues remain bilateral in nature. Relations between Jordan and Israel, between the UAE and Israel, between Sudan and Israel, between Egypt and Israel, none now hide behind the fig leaf of Palestinian demands to avoid peace. They have realized that other interests, both economic and security related, are a top priority, and they have tacitly recognized that Palestinian intransigence is not worthy of their support. Hilariously, former Vice President Joe Biden tried to take credit for the Israel-UAE deal, suggesting that his own communications with the UAE had paved the way for agreement. That's laughable on its face.
In 2014, Biden had to issue a formal apology to the UAE government after suggesting that the UAE supported militants in Syria. Biden's chief contribution to the diplomatic breakthrough was actually the Obama administration's sycophantic embrace of the Iranian regime. By making it clear that the United States could not be relied on to protect Sunni nations from Iranian predations, the Obama administration convinced Arab nations that their interests lie in security alliance with Israel. And so the region has changed for the better. In more honest times, Trump administration officials who brokered this breakthrough would be up for the Nobel Peace Prize. Instead, the news has been largely downplayed in favor of the scandal du jour from Trump's Twitter account. But we should be clear, the first important breakthrough in the Middle East in three decades just took place. And it took place because reality finally set in for Israel's heretofore enemies. Israel isn't going anywhere. Perhaps Palestinians will eventually learn the same lesson, and peace will truly be possible.
This is the local and state page. This is the obituary column for Monday, August 24th, 2020. Wiley Allen Hayden. Wiley Adden Hayden, Jr., 62, passed away on Sunday, August 16th, 2020, in Lubbock, Texas. He was born September 21, 1957, in Austin, Texas, to Wiley Allen Hayden Sr. and Virginia Duncan Hayden. A celebration of Wiley's life will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, August 29th, in Sanders Memorial Chapel. Minister Matt James will be officiating. Please celebrate the life of Wiley by visiting www.sandersfuneralhome.com. A webcast of services will be available, as well as an online guestbook. Loved ones include his son, Wiley A. Hayden III, and wife Janelle, daughter Kim Lucas and husband David, sisters Judy Hayden Stevens and Becky Hayden Schock, grandchildren Caitlin and Ginny Lucas, and numerous extended family. Preceded in death by his parents, Wiley and Virginia Hayden, wife Janet Fry Hayden, and granddaughter Zelena Lucas.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, August 24th. Odessa Strong, 1 year later. Soldier was life of the family. The story was written by Sam Waller. In the year since Cameron Brown's death, his family and friends have learned to deal with the tragedy while acknowledging the sense of loss they all feel. Quote, "It's hard not having him around," Carlton Brown said of his brother. Quote, "He was our laughter, always the life of our family. He always made sure everybody was happy. That's the kind of guy he was. It's been crazy. We lost Cameron, and right after that, like a month later, I lost another friend of mine, and then right after that, it was coronavirus. It's been a wild ride. I do have good people around me to keep my spirits up. It's just been a weird time in the world." End quote. Cameron Brown was one of seven people killed by gunman Seth Ator during a mass shooting on August 31, 2019. The 30-year-old Brown worked at Standard Safety and Supply, a first aid and fire protection service based in Odessa. He was in his company vehicle on his way to work when Ator pulled up beside him in a stolen U.S. Postal Service vehicle and opened fire. A memorial near Ratliff Stadium, where Brown's vehicle would come to a stop that day, still stands. Carlton Brown said the past year has been one of emotional ups and downs for those close to Cameron, from mother Mary Brown, father Carl Coleman, brother Carlos Washington, sisters Shanna and Tiffany Brown, to aunt and uncle Teresa and Ronnie Hogan. Quote, "Honestly, everybody's been dealing with it pretty well," Carlton said. "They have their lapsed moments where they go back into it every once in a while. It hasn't really been easy, but everyone has been taking it pretty well, I think. It's a struggle for our mom, but she's trying, just getting through it. We make sure that we're staying in contact with each other every single day. make sure we check on each other every single day. It comes and it goes. One day, I'm fine, and the next day, I'm in a puddle of tears. I really haven't figured out how to deal with it myself. I tried to stay busy. That's what my mother does. I know that's what I and I know my sisters and older brother do as well. End quote. Carlton Brown, who works for an auto dealership in Sacramento, California, said the family has worked among themselves to honor Cameron's memory and serve as a support group for each other. Quote, "We're doing the best we can in our lives to honor him in the best way we can," he said. "I just make sure that I find time to call everyone and check up on everyone as best I can." End quote. The biggest change in the past year, Carlton said, has been in how he relates to others. Quote, "I'm really focused in on people," he said. "I don't worry too much about the money aspect of life. I really just focus on taking care of the people that are around me. You just never know. It's not something you expect to happen." End quote. Family members from across Texas and California spoke at Cameron's funeral, which was held September 12, 2019, at Victory Life Church in Brownwood. The Abilene Reporter News reported at that time that Mary Brown said her younger son, quote, "was my heart, just as all of my children are. This hit me hard. My life will forever be changed. But looking out into this room, I can tell he was loved," end quote. The Reporter News article quoted other family members who spoke during the service, with Aunt Teresa Hogan telling of conversations she had with Cameron. Quote, "He would ask me, 'What should family be?' Hogan said. 'I'd say, family should be one,'" end quote. Washington, who lived in California while Cameron was in high school, said, quote, "It's been a long time since I've seen my brother. This showed me a lot of people loved him," end quote. Cameron and Carlton Brown grew up in Coleman and graduated from Coleman High School a year apart. While Carlton went to college, Cameron enlisted in the U.S. Army and served in Afghanistan and Iraq. To have his brother survive combat only to die after coming home was particularly difficult to accept, Carlton said. Quote, "That was probably the biggest heartbreaker of all," he said. "You don't expect somebody to go into, at that time in the world, we were at war. This was one of the biggest wars we've had in our lifetime that we've ever seen. For him to survive that, to even walk out of it unscathed and make it home, and then lose his life the way that he did, it just doesn't make sense. Even with that being said, there's just so much turbulence that I still don't understand. For all the families, everyone who lost their life, and everyone who was injured in this, I feel like there needs to be some kind of change." Quote, "It was a senseless thing. I'm not trying to place any blame, but there was a ball dropped somewhere," end quote. Carlton said his brother battled PTSD in the years since receiving a medical discharge from the Army, but had worked hard to deal with his issues. Quote, "I watched my brother from when he was a kid and the stuff we had gone through as youngsters. He was a happy person," Carlton said. "From going into the military to getting out of the military, you could see the change in him. When PTSD would kick in, he would start tripping out and get aggravated about things," end quote. Carlton said the move to Odessa to work for Standard Safety and Supply was a major step forward for Cameron. Quote, "He was struggling to get his life together," Carlton said. "I'll never forget the day we sat down and I told him to just drive to Odessa if you really want to get your life together. It had been hard for him to get and keep jobs. I said, drive to Odessa and go straight to the company and tell them you want a job. Fill out the application and hand it to them. He got hired when he got out there, and he had been doing good. He was in a very happy place. Since the military, that was the first time I'd seen him as happy as he was. He was in the best place he'd ever been in his life since he came back. It was a blessing to see him and him tell me how happy he was. I had literally just gotten off the phone with him a couple of days before all of this happened. For him to go like this was wild for me. That was the craziest thing in the world. End quote. Carlton Brown said the shooting left unfulfilled the potential Cameron had shown. Quote, "He was at a point in his life where I could see everything was going to come into play," Carlton said. "He was solid. He was able to manage the PTSD on his own. He was able to manage his life on his own. He finally took control of everything and was moving in the right direction." End quote. Here are some previews of stories coming up regarding last year's shooting. Angels Watching. This California native didn't even realize he had been shot, let alone twice last year. Still, Joe Glide counts himself as blessed. Meet him and read his story in Wednesday's OA. Odessa dispatchers rose to the occasion during the worst mass shooting in Odessa's history. Go inside their room in Thursday's Odessa American. Fateh Quadri walks with a limp, which he says is an improvement and a gift from God. Meet this family man who was shot three times last year in Friday's OA. An Andrews woman is thankful that she wasn't shot, but continues to recover from an injury that sidelined her for months. See Friday's OA. Some West Texas quilters are using their talents to honor the victims of the August 31st mass shooting. Take a look at these works of art in Saturday's OA. Perla Garcia was widowed after 15 years and four children with husband Raul, who was killed driving his truck near Odessa. Perla reflects on his life and life without him in the August 30th OA. Odessa's top lawmen talk about what was learned from the tragedy and how law enforcement has coped during the last 12 months. Don't miss the August 30th OA. The tiniest victim of the mass shooting is a precious toddler, and her family is giving back in big ways to Odessa. Meet the Davis family in the August 31st OA. A Marine says nothing has been the same. The story was written by Michael Bauer. A year has passed since the August 31st, 2019 tragedy that claimed the lives of seven people and injured 25 others when a gunman went on a shooting spree around Odessa and Midland. Those who survived the horror of that Labor Day weekend continued to heal both physically and emotionally, and that includes Brad Grimsley and his wife Brenda. The Mustang, Oklahoma couple were traveling with Brenda's sister west on Interstate 20 on a planned trip to visit Brenda's parents in Pecos and for a fishing trip that Labor Day weekend. Brad, who was driving, was the first civilian shot during gunman Seth Ator's wild shooting spree that day. Brad and his wife know nothing has been the same since then. Quote, "For me, being a retired Marine and a retired infantry, I've been exposed to different things," Grimsley said. "There are some things that I can't do, like wear blue jeans with a belt right now, so I have to wear shorts and sweats, so there's been a few adjustments," end quote. The Grimsleys, along with Brenda's sister, Kay Perea, were driving from their home in Mustang that weekend when they saw Ator get out of his car on the side of I-20 and shoot DPS trooper Chuck Pryor. After realizing that Ator had jumped back into his car after shooting Pryor, who would survive the attack, they were horrified to realize the gunman was right behind them in his car with a gun hanging out the passenger window. Brad sped off to outpace Ator, who had pulled up beside him. After hitting the brakes and letting Ator speed by, Brad realized he was shot in the lower abdomen. He managed, with wife Brenda's help, to pull off Interstate 20. Ator was eventually shot and killed that same day by law enforcement near Odessa's Synergy Theater. After Brad was shot, he said he wasn't sure if he would pull through. Quote, "As I lay there on the ground, I thought I was dying. Brenda didn't know if I was going to die. 6 minutes after lying on the ground, the ambulance showed up and I was sent over to the hospital. They were working on Chuck Pryor because he was worse off than I was," end quote. But after being worked on at Midland Memorial Hospital, Brad said it was a good hour or two before he knew that everything was going to be okay. His wife, however, had to stay back on I-20 where Brad had pulled the car off the road. Quote, "I was looking for my wife in the lobby, and she wasn't there, and I was getting concerned, and one of the detectives had told me that I could call my wife and found out that she was still at the site because she was a witness and they had impounded my car for evidence. It wasn't until 9 p.m., nearly 6 hours later, when they were both reunited at the hospital. Quote, "It was traumatic. I spent 6 days in the Midland Hospital. It was an experience. It's something that you won't forget for the rest of your life," end quote. For Brenda, those 6 hours might as well have been forever. Quote, "I didn't know if he was alive or dead for 2 hours. They had me in protective custody. We have 7 kids, and I had to pull myself together before calling my mom and dad first and let them know. Everyone's response was, 'How's Brad?' And I didn't know because I'm on the side of the road, and 7 hours later, they're still calling and asking, 'How's Brad?' And I didn't know if he was alive or dead. For those hours, not knowing if a loved one is alive or dead, all you want to do is go," end quote. It wasn't until she got to the hospital when she was finally able to relax. Quote, "When I got to the hospital, finally, I saw Brad and he had already eaten," Brenda said. "I couldn't tell if he was lying to me or not about doing well, but I could finally breathe then, and that's when reality hit. I was seeing the aftermath on TV," end quote. The reason Brad was able to survive and talk about last Labor Day weekend's event was due to the quick action of DPS Trooper Mike Baskerville, who was responding to the report of Trooper Pryor being shot. Baskerville, along with Kay, who was a trauma nurse, were able to save Brad's life. Baskerville and Kay were able to stop the bleeding. While Kay used a sweater to halt the bleeding, Baskerville was able to get gauze to put inside the wound. Brenda and Brad were able to finish that fishing trip, albeit a few months later, as they both returned to the Permian Basin in December 2019. It was one of multiple trips that they've taken down to Pecos, with their most recent one occurring in June. They haven't forgotten where the accident took place. Quote, "Every time we go down mile marker 129, I actually stop and reminisce a little bit, but we've been down there probably 3 times since the shooting," Brad said. To help get through the trauma, Brad said he communicates with his wife nonstop about it. Quote, "I talk with the wife and discuss it with people who ask," Brad said. "I tell the story primarily because of the people who lost their lives and the families that suffered the losses. A lot of people need to look into, at least up here, what actually took place because they didn't know. So dealing with the trauma is something that my wife and I talk about every day. We talk about it every day, and to make sure that everybody's healthy," end quote. Brad and Brenda don't travel as much as they used to prior to the shooting, but that's partly due to the ongoing pandemic. Quote, "Of course we have COVID-19 right now, but we don't travel like we used to," Brenda said. "We're more alert. We make sure that we're protected in any way that we can," end quote. But no matter what, both of them know not to take anything in life for granted. Quote, "We look at life as to not take what you have for granted and to take care of staying alive in this day and age," Brad said. When we came down through the Midland and Odessa area, it was the luck of the draw, I guess you could say. It was like a matter of seconds. All of that took place for us, so it was like from then on, anyone who pulls up next to my side while driving, I look out my window to make sure that the other window is not cracked down too much, because the last time I saw that, a weapon was sticking out, so I'm being cautious, end quote.
Odessa American Obituaries, Monday, August 24th. Billy May Stillwell. Billy May Rogers was born on April 9th, 1927, to her loving parents, M.M. and Ann Rogers, in Corsicana, Texas. She was predeceased by her parents, Mitt and Ann, and her beloved husband, Herbert Jr. Stillwell. She was deeply treasured by all in her extensive family, including her surviving children, Gary Stillwell and wife Julie, Bobby Stillwell, Gail Stillwell and her wife Kathleen Brasfield, and Holly Kemper and her husband Clay. Her grandchildren include Christy Stillwell, Matt Stillwell, Lachey McCullum, Ashley Rogers, and stepchildren Char Booth, Caroline Booth Upshaw, deceased, Brandon Kemper, and Brant Kemper. In lieu of flowers, please donate to the charity of your choice. A visitation will be held Monday, August 24th, 2020, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Frank Wilson Funeral Directors in Odessa. A funeral service will be held Tuesday, August 25th at 2 p.m. with a live stream of the service on Frank Wilson Funeral Directors Facebook. A graveside service will immediately follow the service at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Odessa. Death notices for Monday. Nicolosa Orona Bustamante. Nicolosa Orona Bustamante, 77, died Thursday, August 20th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Mary Catherine Jones. Mary Catherine Jones, 81, of Midland, died Tuesday, August 18th in Midland. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland.
This is Trish reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, August 25th, 2020. Education. Midland ISD business continues without Riddick. Situation is similar to when superintendent is sick or takes vacation, spokeswoman says. By Stuart Doreen. As Midland ISD goes through superintendent termination proceedings, the business of running a school district continues. Superintendent Orlando Riddick is using some of his previously earned vacation days as the board continues with the consideration of and possible action having to do with the termination of his contract, a district spokeswoman said Monday. The Midland ISD board decided last week to move in this direction following a combined 7.5 hours of executive session meetings. On Friday evening, after coming back into regular session, Board President Rick Davis announced a special meeting for 5:30 today. The sole agenda item will be the consideration and possible action to propose mid-contract termination of the superintendent's contract. There is a process that will take place as Riddick's contract is set to expire June 30th, 2022. According to the district, the board would take action to propose mid-contract termination. The superintendent would then be provided written notice that includes the reasons for termination. He then has 15 days to request a hearing from an independent hearing examiner. If he does not request a hearing, the board could then take final action at the next meeting. When a superintendent's future hangs in the balance, isn't much different than when a superintendent is out sick or takes vacation, according to Elena Ladd, the district's chief communications officer. Operations of the district continue, with each team member carrying out their assigned duties. Now, and at all times, each staff member in the district is responsible for executing their daily responsibilities. One such case happened last week when the district staff continued with reentry changes. Chief of Staff Katie Atkins said a public announcement of those changes could take place this week. As the superintendent's designee for reentry planning, the chief of staff is executing the reentry plan in close consultation with other team members and the board, Ladd wrote. Today's meeting is virtual and will include a public comment period following an executive session period. The board is scheduled to take up that sole agenda item having to do with the superintendent's contract. Elections. Dial is pro-teacher, pro-student candidate by Stuart Doreen, sdoreen@hurstnp.com. Joel Dial, D-I-E-H-L, is running for school board as a pro-teacher, pro-student candidate. That, in a nutshell, is his platform. Dial said this week he comes from a family of educators and he is in the process of obtaining his own teaching certification in order to contribute to the selfless teachers that continue to provide quality education in a broken system. He stated that his age, he graduated from Midland High in 2013, and upbringing provide him the unique ability to act as an emissary for students and teachers as a school board member. Dial seeks to represent District 4, which starts in Central Midland near Bowie Fine Arts Academy and works its way across the city, picking up neighborhoods around Sam Houston, Collegiate Preparatory Academy, Midland Alternative Program, Lamar Elementary, Long Elementary, Burnett, and then works its way into Southwest Midland and into the county. John Kennedy, the current representative, is not seeking re-election. Challenging Dial will be Katie Joyner and Steve Vargas. Dial said as a student, he was blessed to have some of the best teachers Midland ISD had to offer, and he wants to make sure a standard of excellence remains in the district. A lot of what teachers do in MISD make up for shortfalls that are there. Dial said one motivating factor in deciding to run for the school board was trustees' decision to rename Robert E. Lee High School. He does not support the renaming and said the decision is an example of a school board that enacted its own will. He said a school board member should listen to constituents and represent them. It is obvious the school board did this with little, no prompting from the community and took little to no consideration from the actions to be taken regarding that issue. He wants to see more communication with constituents, including parents and students. He said a way of doing this includes sending flyers home with students and having the district come up with a district-wide newsletter. Encouraging parents to participate in the process, he said, can be done by providing more than 3 days between when the agenda for a school board meeting comes out and when the meeting is scheduled to take place. He was critical of the district for releasing that information on a Friday afternoon when people are more concerned about their weekend plans. He wants to hold regular meetings with constituents in his district, including discussing issues on the meeting agenda. Dial said a school budget should maximize the amount of money going to educate the kids, trim the fat, and be written to support the teachers. He said there are teachers who are going above and beyond in a system that doesn't reward that type of effort and doesn't encourage personal innovation. Dial is a member of First Baptist Church and has volunteered in the Midland High School Summer Band Program. My platform is simple, Dial said, pro-teacher and pro-student. County. Robertson sworn in as judge of 385th District Court. From staff reports, Austin. Leah G. Robertson was sworn in Monday afternoon as judge of the 385th Judicial District Court in Midland County after she was appointed to the bench by Governor Greg Abbott. She will serve for a term set to expire on December 31st or until her successor is elected and qualified, according to a press release from the governor's office. Chances are that the duly elected person will be Robertson. Last week, Midland County GOP precinct chairs voted to name the attorney as the Republican nominee for the 385th District Court judge. The state position has been open since the end of February when Judge Robin Malone Darr retired after 16 years on the bench. Robertson, a counsel attorney at Ward Myers, is a member of the State Bar of Texas and the Midland County Bar Association and a fellow of the Texas Bar Foundation. She received a Bachelor of Science in Government from Texas Women's University and a Juris Doctor degree from Texas Tech University School of Law. County, Commissioner's Court proposes no new revenue tax rate by Caitlin Randall, C-R-A-N-D-L-E, at MRT.com. After previously delaying the proposal of a 2021 property tax rate, Midland County Commissioners on Monday unanimously voted to propose the no new revenue rate, which will bring in the same amount of property tax revenue as the previous year. The rate proposed by the Commissioner's Court was 12.88 cents per $100 evaluation, slightly above this year's rate of 12.8. Falling property values likely contributed to a higher rate being needed to bring in the same revenue. There was little discussion before Commissioner Randy Prude made a motion to propose the 12.88 rate. Prude made a motion 2 weeks earlier to propose the same rate, but it died for lack of second following confusion over changes that went into effect with the passing of Senate Bill 2. The main cause for confusion during the August 10th meeting was uncertainty over whether the court would be allowed to later set a tax rate higher than what they had proposed. Under SB 2, also known as Texas Property Tax Reform and Transparency Act, they are no longer able to increase the rate after it's proposed. Several commissioners raised concerns August 10th over that stipulation, stating changes to the 2021 county budget, which will not be adopted until September, may make it necessary to adjust the tax rate. However, there was no indication Monday that anyone on the court was seeking a higher tax rate, and the commissioners acknowledged that they would not be able to later raise the rate above 12.88. Proposing the no new revenue rate means there won't be any public hearings to discuss the tax rate. The county previously was required to hold two public hearings regardless of the rate proposed, but Senate Bill 2 removed this requirement if commissioners proposed the no new revenue rate. SB 2 also lowered the cap that determines a voter approval rate. Under SB 2, if the proposed tax rate would bring in more than 3.5% revenue than the previous year, an election is automatically triggered. There was previously an 8% cap on year-over-year revenue before voter approval was needed. The Commissioner's Court last year set the rate just below the 8% cap in anticipation of the lower voter approval rate taking effect this year. The rate that would have triggered an election last year was 12.85. Commissioners were scheduled to discuss County Judge Terry Johnson's proposed 2021 budget during Monday's meeting, but opted to delay that discussion until this morning. The tax rate will be adopted in September along with the county budget. Road bond year two projects are complete. From staff reports, the last of the road bond year two projects are now complete. These projects include varying degrees of water, sewer, and reconstruction work on the following streets: Bluebird Lane, east of Midland Drive, Cuthbert Avenue, Garfield Street to Ward Street, Louisiana Avenue, Garfield Street to A Street, Michigan Avenue, Garfield Street to A Street, Texas Avenue, Andrews Highway to A Street, Carter Avenue, Cotton Flat Road to Big Spring Street, Bankhead Highway, west of Midkiff Road to Front Street, Wood Drive and Oriole Drive, west of Midland Drive, north of Mockingbird Lane. Construction has already started on some year 3, 4, and 5 projects, and final designs and third-party utility relocations are underway on other projects. For more information about the 5-year road bond program, go to midlandtexas.gov/roadbond. District Clerk's Office sends out jury summons, from staff reports. The Midland County District Clerk's Office has sent out 400 jury summons for September 8th and 300 for September 9th. The Clerk's Office did not send these summons in error, according to a press release from Judge Jody Giles. The 142nd District Court will conduct a jury trial on September 8th for a civil commitment. By law, this jury trial must occur before September 27th, according to the release. The Texas Supreme Court ordered judges to follow a certain protocol before a jury trial may proceed. This protocol includes a safety plan for trials in Midland County. Jury selection will occur at the Horseshoe Pavilion. Before entering the building, paramedics will take everyone's temperature and distribute face shields. Masks must be worn to the Horseshoe, but only shields must be worn once voir dire begins. The face shields will not only offer protection, but will allow the judge, court reporter, attorneys, and other jurors to hear and understand each other according to the release. Once the jury is selected, the trial will move to the courthouse. The jurors will be seated in every other chair, not quite 6 feet apart, said Judge Elizabeth Leonard of the 238th District Court in an email. Chairs will be added outside the jury box, she said. The district clerk's office is sending a COVID-19 questionnaire to each potential juror who should respond appropriately. If a potential juror is at high risk for contracting COVID-19 or caring for a high-risk individual, they should call the district clerk's office at 688-9220. Number of COVID cases reported Monday drops by 80% by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at hurstnp.com. The Midland Health Department reported on Monday there were 12 coronavirus cases involving Midland County residents. That was a drop of 80% week over week and the lowest number of cases announced on a Monday going back to mid-June, according to Reporter-Telegram records. The 12 cases also mean the 7-day total of 146 is the lowest case count going back to early June. Today's new cases are reflective of lab results from Friday through Sunday, the city wrote Midland. There are 1,086 isolated cases and 419 under investigation, for a total of 1,505 active cases. 1 week ago, there were 1,378. The number of those recovered was 1,367, a week-over-week increase of 2. There were also 158 people that the health department was unable to locate or who refused to provide an update. Lastly, there are 64 COVID-19-related deaths, an increase of 4 compared to 1 week ago. Comparing the numbers of cases reported on Monday to previous weeks, last week there were 60 cases, which at the time was the lowest total going back to June 22nd. The total Monday was 1/5 of the number of cases week over week. There have been 3,094 cases during the pandemic. Numbers having to do with positivity rates should be available when Midland health officials have a press event this week. Houston Oil Company returns to Permian Basin by Sergio Chapa of the Houston Chronicle. Houston Oil Company Birch Resources has filed its first batch of oil well drilling permits since March. The company plans to drill 10 horizontal wells targeting the Spraberry Field in Howard County in the Permian Basin at depths from 700 to 8,100 feet. Birch is known for naming its oil leases after college mascots, and this batch of projects is no different. Half of the wells will be developed on the company's Sebastian the Ibis lease, named for the University of Miami mascot. The other half will be drilled on the Vic the Demon lease, named for the horned mascot of Northwestern State University in Louisiana. Permian Basin. Midland Oil Company Discovery Operating filed its first drilling permits since June. The company plans to drill 4 horizontal wells on its Great Divide lease in Midland County. The wells target the Spraberry Field at depths of 8,800 to 10,000 feet. The Eagle Ford Shale. British oil major BP filed its first batch of new permits since April in the Eagle Ford Shale of South Texas. The company plans to drill 5 wells on 5 leases in DeWitt County that target the Eagleville Field of the Eagle Ford Geological Formation at a depth of 1,400 feet. Haynesville Shale. Dallas Oil Company Ethon Energy plans to drill 4 natural gas wells split between San Augustine and Shelby counties. The horizontal wells target the Carthage Field of the Haynesville Formation at depths of 12,400 feet to 14,000 feet. Barnett Shale. There are no horizontal drilling permits filed in the Barnett Shale, but Abilene Oil Company Bluff Creek Petroleum plans to drill a vertical well in Shackelford County. The well targets 4 fields to a vertical depth of 1,999 feet. Conventionals. College Station Oil Company Viceroy Petroleum plans to drill a pair of oil wells at the edge of a salt dome 20 miles southwest of downtown Houston near the Fort Bend Parkway Tollway and McCard Road. Marco collapses and sets stage for Laura to hit U.S. as hurricane. By Rebecca Santana and Seth Borenstein of the Associated Press. New Orleans. As Tropical Storm Marco fell apart, The Gulf Coast turned its attention Monday to Laura, another system following just behind that could grow into a supercharged Category 3 hurricane, with winds topping 110 miles an hour and a storm surge that could swamp entire towns. Still a tropical storm for now, Laura churned just south of Cuba after killing at least 11 people in the Dominican Republic and Haiti, where it knocked out power and caused flooding in the two nations that share the island of Hispaniola. The deaths reportedly include a 10-year-old girl whose home was hit by a tree and a mother and son who were crushed by a collapsing wall. Laura was not expected to weaken overland before moving into the warm, deep Gulf waters, and forecasters said it could bring rapid intensification. We're only going to dodge the bullet so many times, and the current forecast for Laura has it focused intently on Louisiana, Governor John Bel Edwards told a news briefing. Shrimp trawlers and fishing boats were tied up in a Louisiana harbor ahead of the storms. Red flags warned swimmers away from pounding surf. Both in-person classes and virtual school sessions were canceled in some districts. In Port Arthur, Texas, Mayor Thurman Barty warned that unless the forecast changes and pushes Laura's landfall farther east, he will ask the city's more than 54,000 residents to evacuate starting at 6 a.m. Tuesday. If you decide to stay, you're staying on your own. Officials in Houston asked residents to prepare supplies in case they lose power for a few days or need to evacuate homes along the coast. "We are battle-tested and we are ready to deal with this situation," Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner said Monday. State emergencies were declared in Louisiana and Mississippi, and shelters were being opened with cots set farther apart, among other measures designed to curb coronavirus infections. Edwards encouraged evacuees to stay with relatives or in hotels, but officials said they made virus-related preparations at state shelters in case they are needed. As Marco was on its deathbed, the National Hurricane Center issued its first storm watches for Laura. Forecasters posted a hurricane watch from Port Bolivar to Morgan City, Louisiana, a tropical storm watch from Port Bolivar to San Luis Pass, Texas, and from Morgan City to the mouth of the Mississippi, where a collapsing Marco hovered. Much of the region was also put under storm surge watch. Forecasters warned of storm surge as high as 11 feet in western Louisiana. Add to that 4 to 10 inches of rain expected when Laura arrives starting late Wednesday. By late afternoon, Marco clung to its 40-mile-an-hour winds away from its pulled-apart center, which was 15 miles southeast of the mouth of the Mississippi River. Forecasters predicted it would no longer be a tropical storm by the end of the night. Laura was struggling to organize around its center as part of the system scraped over Cuba, preventing the wind from strengthening beyond 60 miles an hour, but scientists at the National Hurricane Center predicted that would not last. Once Laura moves into the toasty waters of the Gulf of Mexico that serve as fuel for storms, forecasters predict it will rapidly strengthen to hurricane status ahead of an expected Wednesday landfall. The question is just how much. "I would still give it a pretty decent chance of a Category 3 or 4, not necessarily at landfall, at least during its lifetime in the Gulf," University of Miami hurricane researcher Brian McNulty said. "Many, but not all, storms in that area weaken just before landfall because of a late influx of dry air." Mandatory evacuation orders were issued for much of Cameron Parish on the Texas border, where officials said seawater pushed inland by the storm could submerge communities, including Cameron, population about 410 people. "We want everybody to get out safely," said Ashley Buller, the Assistant Director for Emergency Preparedness. The punch from back-to-back storms comes just days before the August 29th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which breached the levees in New Orleans, flattened much of the Mississippi coast, and killed 1,800 people in 2005. August Crapel, chief of the United Houma Nation, was worried about the group's 17,000 members spread out over six parishes along the Louisiana coast. He took part in a ceremony Saturday at the Superdome in New Orleans that included Native American singing and prayers to commemorate the Hurricane Katrina's 15th anniversary. "We know our people are going to get hit. We just don't know who yet." He's been in contact with the Red Cross to get supplies once the weather eases. On the Louisiana coast at Holly Beach, in an area nicknamed the Cajun Riviera, Eric Monceau was frantically packing what he could take with him. Hit first by Hurricane Rita in 2005 and again by Ike in 2008, he does not plan to come back if Laura does its worst. That would be strike three. I'm 62. I gave it 2 strikes. The third one is strike three, you're out, just like a baseball game. From the opinion page, guest view, Dan Patrick should stop defending Confederate statues. Last week, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick whiffed on a request by 12 state senators to remove Confederate memorials from the Capitol grounds. Those 12, all Democrats, sent Republican leaders a meatball, an easy pitch to knock out of the park. All that was needed to score big was for Patrick and Governor Greg Abbott to state unequivocally that they oppose racism, schedule a meeting, and leave it at that. In fact, Patrick did state, "I and every Republican in the Texas Senate also oppose racism in any form," but only after 1,105 words of combative nonsense. Patrick declined to be interviewed for this editorial, but his letter warrants close examination because it reveals many of the most obdurate misunderstandings of our nation's current debate about race, leadership, and history. Let us start with that history. It only took Patrick 2 sentences to get to the false assertion that to remove Confederate monuments is to erase history. The history will remain regardless, but as former Republican Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives Joe Strauss and former Democratic member of the Texas Senate Rodney Ellis wrote in these pages last month, life-size tributes to Confederate military leaders do not teach history. They catechize myth. This is actually a debate about which elements of our history to venerate and how to account for the harmful legacy of slavery and sharecropping and convict leasing and lynching and voter suppression and segregation, redlining, and all the many ways racism has adapted to new chapters in American history. Monuments to America's military and ideological enemies do not preserve our history, they distort it. One of the signatories of the Democrats' letter, State Senator Royce West from Dallas, told us he has no interest in changing or erasing history. Speaking about the 9-foot-tall painting of Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston displayed in the Senate chamber, West said, "I don't want to see it removed from history. I just want to see it placed in its proper context." We agree. Patrick's letter admits that some chapters in Texas history included periods of injustice and inequality, and he rightly argues that it's what we have done as a nation and a state to correct the injustices that defines us. It is true that America's journey has been a march toward expanding individual rights, though that march has been an uneven one, which is why we believe that what Patrick and other defenders of the Confederate legacy are now doing, or not doing, to correct injustice will define them. Let's be clear. This is not a partisan issue. Not all Republicans are on the wrong side of it, but there is a wrong side. There is no good reason for the state of Texas to venerate military leaders whose cause was immoral and whose enemy was the United States. To do so is to enshrine injustice. Patrick's letter does hint at progress. Buried in the rubble of his argumentativeness is a paragraph in which he describes his efforts to actually deal with the issue. He scheduled a hearing for December 2019, which was later postponed, and he promises another hearing before the next legislative session. This is all that was needed. He just needed to have done so without giving cover to defenders of Confederate symbolism. At this political moment, leadership on this issue matters. The Dallas Morning News. Obituaries and death notices for August 25th, 2020. Henrietta Louise Johnson. Our loving, funny, and ever-practical mother, Henrietta Louise Johnson, passed away at home Saturday morning, August 22, 2020. Henrietta is survived by her son, Edward Johnson, and wife, Nikki of Spring, Texas, and her daughter, Lena Weatherford of Midland, Texas. Her grandchildren are Matthew Weatherford and wife, Leah of Big Spring, Texas, Natalie Johnson and husband Ryan Krug of Spring, Texas, Callie Reams, husband Mark of Midland, Texas, and Rice Johnson, also of Midland. Her great-grandchildren are Michael and Zoe Reams, Eleanor Weatherford, and Theodore and Sybil Krug. We would like to acknowledge her very special friend Jan Lacey, who so lovingly cared for her. Visitation will be Tuesday, August 25th, from 5 to 7 at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Graveside services will be at Rest Haven Cemetery Wednesday, August 26th at 11 a.m. Honorary pallbearers are her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Lone Star Sanctuary for Animals at 4200 North Fairgrounds Road, Midland, Texas. 79705. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at npwelch.com. Death notices. Mary Catherine Evans. Mary Catherine Evans, 81, of Midland, passed from this life August 18, 2020, in Midland, Texas. She is survived by her children, Zane Evans, John Stephen Evans, and Karen Evans Dyke, and one brother. There are no services scheduled at this time, and arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.